Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, as promised last week, we're going to continue our discussion of central banks, which are in the news again and will be even again next week as the Fed considers whether to raise interest rates once again, which it will. That's already baked into the numbers. We'll talk next week about the Fed decision and some other central bank decisions in Europe and in China, where there are signs of growing instability in the banking systems. Okay, so let's begin. Well, what was the news of this past week? Well, you look at it, everybody's watching this Comey dog and pony show on TV here about, FBI Director James Comey here in front of Congress. Why do I call it a dog and pony show? Well, simply because nothing's really discussed there in the public for the public consumption hearing. It's all really discussed in private, so they don't really let us hear what's going on, what's been said. Well, you know, in the public version, all we got was two things. One, Trump lied, according to Comey. No, he defamed me again and again. That's the only thing that came out besides this continual manipulation of these hearings to point the finger at Russia intervention in elections, U.S. elections. So those were the two public topics that were repeated over and over again in the public hearing here with Comey, but who knows what they discussed in private. Anyway, virtually no news except entertainment. While that was going on, of course, there were some very interesting developments economically going on this past week, which will give us a segue into discussing our part two of Central Bankers on the Ropes, the Origins and Toxic Legacies of the Federal Reserve. Okay, what were these events of the past week? Well, one very ominous event was the bank run and collapse of the Spanish bank called Banco Popular. All right, a classical bank run occurred on this Spanish bank. And there are many other similar conditioned banks, particularly in Spain, Portugal, and Italy and Greece, that are in the same shape. Because, 8 years later, after the crash of 2008-09, the European banking system has not been restabilized for various reasons, which I cover in a chapter in my book, which comes out in a couple of weeks, called Central Bankers on the Ropes, Monetary Policy in the Next Depression. European Central Bank, the ECB, did not, and Europe did not really clean up the bad debts on their banks. They let them languish there for 8 years, and in fact, they got worse in 2011-12 when Europe had its double-dip recession. They've never cleaned them up, and part of the reason is that the ECB is not really, and has not been, at least initially here, a central bank in the true sense of being able to bail out other banks, central banks, and banks in the Eurozone. We're talking about the Eurozone here, not the Bank of England and those countries that have their own central banks outside the Eurozone, like in Scandinavia. Slowly the European Central Bank has very, very slowly evolved towards a true bona fide central bank, but it still is not a true bona fide central bank, a chapter of which I dedicate there in the book. So we have, this Banco Popular collapse here last week. And it was sold off to another Spanish bank, Santander, for 1 euro. Yes, what's a bank run? A bank run is when depositors, in this case what we call retail depositors, you know, people who just put their savings and checking accounts in the bank, realize that the bank is about to go belly up and they run down. That's why they call it a bank run. And they take their money out, which means it's certainly going to collapse. But runs occur and collapses occur when the bank no longer has sufficient funds to give those who come and claim and want their money. Why is that? Because all of capitalist banking is based upon a system called fractional reserves banking. These banks hold only just a pittance of the money that was actually deposited in them. In the U.S., what is the fraction that's really held by the banks? Oh, I would say it varies with the size of the bank and the bank branch, but well under 10%, maybe under 5%. Some banks have virtually, small banks have virtually no reserves on hand. And larger banks in big cities, you know, maybe have 5% on hand. So they loan out everything that's been given, deposited, because that's how they make their money. In other words, you put your money in and they give you a few percent, if that. Now you don't even get that, right? And then the banks loan it out at much higher rates. It's called the spread. And that's one way they make a lot of money. Right? And that's what's been happening for 8 years now. The banks are paying you and I in your savings and checking accounts and CDs and so forth less than 0.1% probably. But they're taking that money and they are investing it, giving them, you know, investing it offshore, investing it to institutionals who financial institutions that speculate in stock and bond markets and foreign exchange markets and derivative markets, right? And make you know, double-digit returns, and the banks make maybe 6-8%. So they pay you less than 0.1%. They loan out 6-8%. They themselves also invest in these stocks and bonds and securities markets and all the other markets out there, and make a lot of money that way. Well, this has been going on for 8 years since 2010. We've had near zero interest rates. And in fact, less than zero, if you adjust it for inflation, the banks get to borrow for free. And the banks then either put that money back in the Federal Reserve. When I say borrow, I mean borrow. Banks borrow from the Federal Reserve. You and I can't, but banks can. Shadow banks can. They borrow from the Federal Reserve, and then they do this process of paying, loaning out at higher rates, you see. And in the U.S., the Federal Reserve actually pays the banks interest. In other words, you can go borrow from the Federal Reserve, you know, or federal funds rate between banks, which is determined by the Federal Reserve, for until 6 months ago at virtually 0.1% from the Federal Reserve. And then the Federal Reserve says, okay, you want to park your money here, leave it with us. When you, after you borrowed from us or you borrowed from another bank at 0.1%, you can put it in the Federal Reserve, and we'll pay you, the Federal Reserve, the central bank, will pay you 0.25%, right? So we borrow money and just let it sit, and you make money off of that. Yeah, that's been going on since 2009, 2010 in the U.S., back to Banco Popular. What's happened here is people realize the bank is about to go belly up. So what do? They run down and they say, give us our money out. But it doesn't have any money to give out. It's loaned it all out, or it's, you know, invested and so forth here and there. And it can't sell the assets right away. So what happens? Well, the bank goes bankrupt. As a result, and you can have these what's called retail bank runs. In other words, retail means average depositors like you and I, you know, your checking and savings accounts and so forth. A commercial bank is a retail bank. takes deposits. But then there's all kind of banks that aren't retail banks, like shadow banks, investment banks, and so forth. And their depositors are the super wealthy and super rich institutions that corporations, right, that invest. That's the difference between an investment bank, shadow banks, and depositor commercial banks. But the two have blended. You know, they're commercial banks act like shadow banks. You know, like J.P. Morgan Chase. You know, is really engages in shadow banking kind of activities, and vice versa. You know, some of the biggest shadow banks now are acting like banks. So the lines blend quite a bit. And talk about blending, news last week of Amazon. Amazon's becoming a bank. Yes, Amazon's now going to loan to people, right? This is this, you know, you can borrow loans from Amazon. This is part of this whole peer-to-peer networking stuff, crowdfunding or whatever you want to call it, where non-banks are getting into banking functions. This poses some big problems for central banks that are supposed to supervise and regulate banks when banks are no longer, quote, banks, but non-banks acting like banks. You know, how does the central bank supervise them and make sure they don't do things that end up in financial instability? Well, that's another problem, but it is a problem. Okay, so Banco Popular collapses. And the European Central Bank arranges a purchase of Banco by the other big bank in Spain, Santander. Arranges, what does that mean? That means it enables and authorizes Santander to buy Banco for 1 euro. In other words, gives it to Banco. Now, we did that in the U.S. too, you know. Back in 2008, when the investment bank Bear Stearns collapsed, what happened? The Federal Reserve stepped in and did a deal and virtually gave the bank, Bear Stearns, to J.P. Morgan Chase. Yeah, virtually. How much? Well, $2 billion. Chase got to buy Bear Stearns for $2 billion. But the Federal Reserve gave a $29 billion loan to Chase to buy the bank for $2 billion. You know, and the bank just, you know, Bear Stearns just 3 months earlier was worth, you know, over $100 billion maybe. Its building in New York City was worth more than $2 billion. So, you know, the Federal Reserve cuts the deal with a private, big private bank, Chase, and turns over Bear Stearns to Chase. Capitalists to gobble their own. They eat their own all the time, right? They're cannibals. Capitalist banks are cannibals, economic cannibals. And the federal government plays ball with them and enables them to do so. You know, we have more concentration, meaning fewer big banks than we ever had before. You know, and part of the problem is the banks are too big to fail, as they say, and that means the government has to always bail them out. And that was a good example, Bear Stearns. Anyway, parallels between Banco Popular and Bear Stearns. Another thing that needs to be added here about Banco Popular is that people aren't aware, but the money you put in the bank is not your money anymore. Once you put it in the bank owns that money. Yeah. That's their money, and they can do what they want with it, including if there is a bank run and you go down in the Wells and you say, I want my money out, what the government and the banks can do is say, no, we're not going to give you your money out. What we're going to do is give you, exchange it for some Wells Fargo bank stock. Yeah, we're going to convert your cash to a bank stocks, and we're going to give it to you in stocks. That's called a bail-in, and that's coming next time. It's already been piloted, bail-ins, by the way, in Europe, in Cyprus and elsewhere. They had their banking crashes a few years ago. And the U.S. and the U.K. have already undertaken, developed plans for bail-ins next time. Bail-ins, yes. There may be a cutoff point. In other words, if you have less than maybe $50,000, you won't be bailed in. You won't have your cash exchanged for stock. No one knows what the cutoff point will be. It depends on the size of the bank and the degree of the crisis. But some people will have their cash, their investments, converted to stock. Now, the stock's going to be worthless, virtually, when the bank has to be bailed out, you see. How are banks bailed out, then? What is, you know, what's the typical process that leads up to a solution, as we just described here in Banco Popular and Bear Stearns, where another bank is brought in to purchase it, and the government subsidizes the purchase? Well, typically, if a bank is in trouble, the central bank calls on the bank to raise more capital. Capital in this case means money, cash, money capital, liquid capital, right? If it raises more capital, of course, you know, it can pay out more to people who are demanding their money. Let's assume it's a commercial bank and you know, want to take it and run. Right? So raising more capital issues is the key. The bank in trouble can, you know, issue more stock in that sense. That will raise capital. Or you could have a group of other banks get together, a consortium, it's called, and they put money into a pool for, you know, the bank in trouble. Of course, the bank in trouble will have to pay back someday, but, you know, a consortium, an emergency a loan collected by the other private banks. Okay. The central bank can also engage in what's called stress tests and accounting gimmickry. The stress tests and gimmickry are designed to make it look like the bank is not really in that bad a shape, so buyers of the stock will step up and purchase the stock, and the bank can raise capital. Right? Stress tests. And they're phony. Stress tests are phony. You know, we won't go into the details in this show, but, you know, stress tests were created in 2009 by the Federal Reserve. And what the Federal Reserve does is create a scenario of a crisis and gives that scenario to the banks, and the banks then reply as to how they would survive that scenario. And of course, they're going to survive it. You know, they're going to manipulate the numbers to look like they survive it well enough. And then the Federal Reserve Central Bank decides, oh, okay, so your solution to this scenario convinces us, and you're good, right? Or the Federal Reserve will make this subjective determination. No, we don't believe your numbers. You're not good. Do something else. Sell off some more of your assets. See, that's another way that a bank in trouble before it's bailed out is addressed. Right? Sell off some of your best assets. That's what Citigroup did after the 2009-10 crash. Consolidated and shrunk. It sold off some of its better properties and businesses around the world because it expanded too much. So selling off assets to raise cash, to raise capital, right? Issuing stock to raise capital, given a consortium loan is capital, and a stress test, another accounting gimmickry, is created to justify and make it look like the bank's okay. You can. John Q. Public, you can buy some of the stock. Accounting gimmickry also takes a role here. What do I mean by that? Well, in 2009, you know, banks were in deep doo-doo in the U.S., and we had the stress tests, and then we had also Congress, particularly the House Banking Committee, led by Barney Frank, And what they decided was, it's okay, banks, you can lie about your condition. What did that mean? That meant you could suspend mark-to-market accounting. What was that? That was, okay, tell the truth of how bad you are, mark-to-market. And what Barney Frank in Congress, a big liberal, Barney Frank said was, okay, you guys can lie. You can suspend mark-to-market. Well, that makes them look better, doesn't it? And encourages people to buy the stock. Because the stock has collapsed. Oh, it looks like the government's stepping in. We have stress tests. They don't look that bad. You know, and okay, let's buy the stock, raise capital. So, or sell off your assets, right? And if it gets bad enough, if that's not sufficient to, quote, rescue the bank, then the government will step in and buy off the bad loans. In 2009, it was, you know, mortgage loans, subprime mortgage loans and treasuries and so forth. That's called QE, quantitative easing, where the bank prints money and doesn't raise it from taxes, prints the money electronically, and goes and buys those assets, takes those bad assets off of the balance sheets of these banks and puts it on its own Federal Reserve balance sheet. That's why today the Federal Reserve balance sheet is $4.5 trillion. That's one way of pumping liquidity into these private banks in trouble. There's other ways as well, but that's a direct way, you see. And then the government can either, the central bank rather, can either hold those bad loans on its own balance sheet, as I said, or in some cases in Europe and elsewhere in the past, what they've done is take those bad assets and put it in a wholly government-owned, what they call bad bank, bad asset bank, right? And then slowly over time, the government sells off those bad assets as the prices begin to rise sometimes, and they sell them off cheap, in other words, not at full market rates, to other capitalists who want to buy the loans because they know they're rising again. Right, so they subsidize other capitalists at their own expense. So let's call it a bad bank solution. Or the government can just buy preferred stock and debt from these institutions like AIG in 2009-10. Actually happened. The government bought and held these bad assets, right? Okay, so that's how that... Those various methods are the ways in which banks are bailed out. Right? In the very extreme case, if the government doesn't want to buy the bad assets, in other words, like the Federal Reserve has a rule that the assets of the bank, it has to have some good loans as collateral for buying it out. If that doesn't work, then, of course, they will either allow the bank to collapse, as they did with Lehman Brothers, or they will arrange a consolidation of the bank, as they did with Washington Mutual, bank in back in 2008-09. And that's exactly what they did with Banco Popular here, right? But the problem is... even if Banco Popular has been rescued, the problem is, what signal does it take, does it send, rather, to the rest of people, depositors in Europe, that, well, gee, Banco Popular collapsed. Maybe, you know, maybe my bank will collapse, too. We don't know yet, you know. There are a lot of banks in Europe that have trillions of dollars of non-performing bank loans. In other words, they loaned out all this money during the boom period, and the borrowers went bankrupt, you know, collapsed themselves and or can't pay and haven't been paying principal and interest on these loans. And these loans are sitting there on bank balance sheets, like Banco Popular, right, or Monte dei Paschi in Italy and other Italian banks, right, or Banco Novo in Portugal, so forth, sitting there, just sort of, you know, swamping the whole system. How much in Europe? Well, well over $2 trillion. $2 trillion for 8 years sitting there, you know, just poisoning the whole banking system. And they haven't cleaned it up, you see. They haven't cleaned it up. Now we got... Banco Popular collapsing, and what does this mean for people thinking about in Italy and Portugal, elsewhere? That gee, maybe we sure, they got bailed out, but maybe we ought to quickly go and get our money out, especially since it's clear that the European Central Bank has decided that bail-ins is a useful tool, and they're going to use it. They already used it. We better get our money out. Well, let's watch closely what happens here to the banking system. That situation is partly why the European Central Bank decided last week as well to continue its quantitative easing program. In other words, it's going to continue to buy tens of billions of bonds every month. I think the number is 60 billion. 60 billion euros of bonds, $66 billion every month. In other words, it's buying up these bonds, even from good banks. In fact, most of the bond buying is from banks and investors in Germany and elsewhere who don't really need to sell these bonds. And they start with government bonds held by private sector, buy them back. But they're running out of them, so they start buying corporate bonds. In Japan, not just corporate bonds, they're running out of those. They're buying stocks of companies. And they're buying derivatives of various kinds, from real estate and ETFs and so forth. You know, so what you got here in the 21st century is central banks, quasi-government institutions, that are supposed to act like government institutions, but they're really acting like private banks. They're buying up these securities, stocks, bonds, and so forth, propping up these companies. They're pumping money into these companies. More and more of them are not able to survive in the 21st century global capitalism, but they're subsidizing them. They're buying them up. That's like an investment bank, a private equity firm, right? Central banks are becoming like private equity firms, buying up companies. Wow, what's happening here? Well, this is part of the evolution of 21st century global capitalism going on the financial side. So the ECB, realizing the situation in Europe is not still all that well, and all this talk about recovery, that's all hype, you know. That's all expectations of maybe there will be a change in the direction of the economy, which isn't going to happen. Right. Now, in the U.S., we have other signs last week of other problems continuing to brew on the financial side. The junk bond market. Junk bond are companies who can't borrow at reasonable rates, low rates. They, because of their economic condition, they have to pay a lot more to borrow, a lot riskier. You know, they borrow at 10-12% instead of at 4-5% from banks and other sources. That's called junk bond or high yield bond. Well, we have a big sector that called the energy sector, as U.S. Fracking companies fight with the Saudis, and prices, you know, drive down. Oil prices drive down, which are falling once again below 50, as I predicted last year. What happened? This oil price collapse is not anywhere near resolution. But now, you know. Not just the energy fracking companies who've loaded up on junk bonds, but now we've got the retail sector in trouble in the U.S., particularly department stores. Companies like Nordstrom and Penney's and Macy's and Sears are all in deep doo-doo, and they've been borrowing junk bonds because they're in doo-doo, and they're in trouble. You know, their profits are collapsing because of competition, particularly from online. And what's ominous here is that speculators have now jumped into this market and are short-selling the stock of these retail giants. Well, what's short-selling? Short-selling is betting that the stock price of these companies will collapse. So you can make money that way on collapsing stock prices, just as you can on rising stock prices. And, you know, hedge funds and so forth, Paul Singer, Elliott Management, and Mercer's, and all these big shadow bankers, who are close friends, by the way, of Donald Trump, are pushing the stock prices down, causing them to collapse even further. This is a red flag sign of deep trouble in the sector. This is what occurred, you know, with Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers and those banks in 2008. And it's occurring now in the retail sector. Should we have a recession, most of these retail companies are going to go belly up. Certainly Sears is going to go. Macy's is changing its whole business model. Instead of trying to sell to mid-tier buyers, it's becoming a more like a dollar department store. Penny's is in trouble. They're even, you know, they're acting like Walmart's. Companies, high-end Nordstrom's and Dillard's, those companies are trying to go private. In other words, get out of this short-selling pressure cycle here by buying up their own stock and preventing it from happening. Okay, so the retail sector, watch it, it's in trouble in the U.S. Big layoffs occurring at the same time in the retail sector, which has been an important source of part-time contingent job hiring, which is mostly what the jobs have been here, which, by the way, you know, the job numbers are beginning to weaken significantly in the last couple months as well. Okay. So watch the junk bond market here and the retail sector in the U.S. financially. Watch oil prices watch what happens in Europe, because now it looks like with the vote in England, it's going to be a hard Brexit. What that means, no one knows yet, right? Just another quick reference to developments before we get on to the origins of the Federal Reserve of events this past week here. The U.S. House passed what's called the Financial Choice Act, which is the first big slashing of the Dodd-Frank Bank Regulation Bill of 2010. You know, they're gonna pick that apart, peel it apart. Particularly, they don't like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which has been protecting consumers against financial manipulation and fraud and so forth by banks and other payday loan players and so forth. It's one of the few things that was really good about the Dodd-Frank Act. That's the Banking Regulation Bill, Dodd-Frank, 2010. Which, by the way, when they passed it in 2010, they gave it 7 years to implement, you see, 7 years. In other words, you pass this weak bank a regulation bill, and then you give the banking lobby 7 years to pick it apart. Yeah, which is exactly what they've been doing. So it's just a shell of what it is. But, you know, that protection agency is a Consumer Protection Agency Bureau is, you know, one of the better elements of that bill, and they're going to pick that apart. And that's the new Financial Choice Act passed this week from the House. You see, a lot of stuff going on behind this dog and pony Comey show here that's far more important than what's going on in the political entertainment circus, you know. Keep you all preoccupied with nonsense where you don't... While the big bankers and the generals who run the Trump administration, you know, it's billionaire bankers like Goldman Sachs and in all the key positions, and the generals, you know, rebel generals from the Joint Chiefs and so forth, who are running foreign policy and, you know, security and so forth. This is what we got, you know. Well, this clown tweets, does his tweet thing, you know, and is really just a figurehead here. He's not really running the show. Right. And he announces, by the way, this infrastructure week, right? Remember, he runs on this promises of $1 trillion in infrastructure spending. We're going to rebuild our roads and so forth, right? Stimulate, never going to happen, right? But he throws out this thing called Infrastructure Week last week, you know, and this big PR event we're going to privatize, change over, rebuild our air traffic control system. Hmm? That's infrastructure. Well, it's infrastructure, right? But he's privatizing the whole process, you see. Infrastructure means privatization. That's what Trump infrastructure spending is. It's not the government, allocating for roads and bridges and so forth. You know, that's what they tell you. But it's really going to be all about privatization, private-public partnerships, which, as I said before, work like the PPI partnership in Los Angeles, where builders, developers, real estate exploiters like Trump strike deals with local governments. In other words, you give us your old property where your city office buildings were in L.A. Give us that property. And in exchange for that property, which is going to appreciate in value, we're going to build you a new city center, city government center, right? And then you just, we're going to own the city government center, we, the real estate developers, and you can lease it from us, city government. So you lease it from the developers. They get this constant income stream from lease payments for the new city buildings, and they get to keep the old properties where they're really going to make a killing. And they're going to tear down those old city buildings. They're going to build their new hotels and who knows what, you know, stadiums, sports stadiums, and all the other nonsense that they do. And they're going to make a real killing on that property. That's what this whole thing is about, you see. That's the kind of deals that Trump has always been involved in, both in the U.S. and globally, you know. These cutting these deals with local governments and other bankers and so forth, that's what he's calling infrastructure. But it's really going to be privatization. We'll see if it even happens. You know, it's privatization. Infrastructure means the government's going to provide loans and or guarantees for this whole process, and the developers, commercial property developers, are going to get filthier rich off of all of it, and the governments are going, the local governments are going to be able to get nice new buildings, and at the same time, they're going to get out from under having to pay for a loan to build the property. They just lease it. They just lease it, you see. It's not different from all this other leasing gimmickry going on, which are really tax shelters of various kinds. Okay, so let's move on to the Federal Reserve, its origins, and its toxic legacies. But keep in mind, you know, all this interesting stuff, real stuff that affects your real standard of living is going on behind the scenes. Oil prices falling, junk bond problems growing, banks failing and being rescued in Europe, right? Deregulation going on, infrastructure privatization going on. Okay. Central banks, the Federal Reserve, right? For most of the 19th century, the U.S. Had no central bank. We had tens of thousands of private banks. And all those private banks had no supervision. They could do whatever they want. You know, you set up a bank, people come in, they give you your money, and then you close the bank and move on to the next city. You know, there was a lot of that stuff going on in the 19th century. Thousands and thousands, 10,000, 20,000 small banks throughout the U.S. With no supervision. And each one with its own currency, you see. There was no single currency. For a while, you know, the federal government during the Civil War created greenbacks, you know, but that was only one of many sources of currencies. It wasn't the only source of currency. You can't regulate all the speculation and so forth that goes on when everybody can create their own currency. That was a problem. Right. Central banks, as I said last week, originate when a private bank, a big private bank, becomes the primary source of raising money for governments. In other words, it goes out from it knows all the nooks and crannies of you know, who's got money and so forth, and it sells government bonds to these investors and other banks on behalf of the government. The government raises money to finance its wars or projects of various kinds. So central banks start as a private bank, and that private bank aspect of central banks still exist today. Still. It's obfuscated, right? It's opaque, but it still exists. The connections between the private banks and the central bank, between the private banks and the Federal Reserve, are still significant. Not overt, you know, not so obvious as they once were, including at the time of the creation of the Federal Reserve. The small banks did not like the idea of one of their bigger brethren becoming that powerful, being able to raise all this money for the government, because in raising the money for the government, they got all the inside information on where government spending might occur, and they got in early. They had the connections, the lobbying connections, and they got the best deals, you see. So the small banks didn't like the big banks doing that, becoming a central bank. And that's why the first two banks of the United States in 1836 collapsed. Right? The smaller banks did not like the bigger banks, which a big bank, which became, you know, the preferred big bank of the federal government. So they opposed it. And they didn't like the idea of a single currency either. They liked the idea of being able to create their own currencies and make their own deals, speculate themselves, you see. So for the whole 19th century, we went on with this lack of a central bank and everybody having their own currencies. And every 5-6 years, we had a banking crisis and crash. And sometimes when the crashes got very bad, we had a big depression, like in 1837-43, big depression, 1873-78, big depression, 1892-98, big depression. And then 1907, we had another big banking crash, right? 1907 financial crash. Well, it's from that financial crash that the origins of the U.S. Central Bank emanate. In 1907, the U.S. economy had gotten so large that when there was the crash and it dragged down other banks, because there's always contagion here in a banking system, and the contagion started in what were called the trusts in New York, kind of shadow banks. Very, very rich folks put their money in the trust, kind of like in investment banks today, or private equity, or hedge funds. You see, very, very rich put their money there. And these trust shadow banks engage in very high risk, high return financial activity. That's where the rich people want to put their money. They want to put their money in where they're going to make big returns. Well, where there's big returns potential, there's big risk potential. And periodically, these big risk returns collapse. Well, we had a big banking crash in 1907, on its way to another depression, as similar to the three that we had during the 19th century, because there was no central single currency with which to try to maintain financial stability. Through which, you see, and there's no banking supervision. There's no institution to supervise these banks from engaging in this speculative, high, unstable activity throughout the 19th century and into 1907, right? And central banks evolve taking on these new functions of creating the single currency and trying to supervise the private banking system, right? Those are the functions. Central banks start out just as raising money for a private bank raising money for the government, and then the government says, "Oh, okay, we're having all these crashes and everything. We need a single currency." And then, we're still having these crashes. We need some sort of banking supervision. And when we have these crashes, someone's got to bail them out, so there's got to be a lender of last resort. It's called bailout, same thing. The first bank, Central Bank, Bank of England, only gains control of its currency, the right to issue a monopoly of single currency, in 1844. And, of course, the U.S. Only has that sense of control when it creates the Federal Reserve in 1913. Central banks are a recent capitalist innovation, you see. And they've been evolving over time in terms of what their functions are, what their tools are, what, you know, what they're trying to target. Main functions are, of course, providing the currency, regulating the money supply, providing the currency, a monopoly on the currency. Today, after 1913, all these other banks, small banks, 20,000, could not create their own currencies. You know, they had to use the Federal Reserve currency. And in 1913, you know, we develop rudimentary means by which to supervise the private banks, rudimentary, in hopes of trying to prevent banking crashes and, you know, system-wide banking crashes. Of course, the banking supervision is always very, very minimal, so it never really succeeds. And then the central bank has to go and bail out the banks that crash. You see, in 1907, before we had a central bank, when we had the crash, what happened was a group of wealthy bankers in New York, because that's where it was centered, attempted to create a consortium of raising funds, as I mentioned earlier, to bail out the banks that were crashing and the trust funds that were crashing. Right? But the banking system had gotten so large in the U.S. by that time, even they could not put their money up. And, of course, they don't like putting their money up. They'd rather have someone else put their money up to bail them out. Right? The consortium approach failed to stop the banking crash in 1907-8. And they had to call on the U.S. Treasury to bail them out. And the Treasury bailed them out. Because there was no central bank yet, you see. So where are you going to bail out? Oh, the U.S. Treasury bailed them out. Treasury used just about all the capital it had to bail out these banks and stop the bank run. But when the Treasury bails out, Treasury's part of the U.S. government, the politicians get blamed for it, you see. And that was the taxpayer directly bails them out through the Treasury. And the politicians don't like that because what happens is that you have a crash in the Depression caused by the banks, and then our elected representatives have to go bail them out. That's doubly bad for politicians. They not only did not prevent the collapse, but then they bail out the people who made the collapse, and they don't bail out the rest of us. Sound familiar? Yes, that's what exactly happened after 2008-9. Banks got bailed out. By 2010, the U.S. banks were all bailed out. Well, we kept interest rates low for another 7 years. We subsidized the banks for another 7 years, even though they were all bailed out. Why did we do that? Well, we'll talk about that in the future show here, the consequences of that. Well, anyway, going back to 1907, the Treasury bails out all the banks because the consortium of, you know, J.P. Morgan, actual guy J.P. Morgan, and others at the time, could not bail out the banks, so the government stepped in. Well, that wasn't a good solution anymore in the 20th century, to have the taxpayer directly bail out the banks. You know, wasn't good. And of course, it had a lot to do with the progressive movement that erupted about that time in U.S. history, reform movement of sorts. So what happened was the bankers got together and said, you know, with key government people, said, we can't have this kind of solution anymore where the Treasury taxpayer has to directly bail us out, and we don't want to put our own money up to bail out each other anymore because it's really too much. So what's the solution? The solution is to get a central bank to do it. Because the central bank will just print the money. You see, you don't have to borrow the money from the taxpayer. They will print the money. Give the central bank the authority to print the currency and make sure it's the only currency that's used. Those ban all other banks from creating their own dollars. And there were, you know, up until then, there were all kind of dollars, 10,000 different kinds of dollars out there, you know, Bank of Savannah dollar, you know, the Bank of Memphis dollar, etc. So that was all prohibited, and the Federal Reserve was given the right to have a monopoly of paper currency. and was given the responsibility, the function of bailing out the banks. Managing the money supply, monopoly of currency, and lender of last resort. You know, these are the modern primary functions of central banks. By the way, why did we call it Federal Reserve? Why didn't we call it Central Bank of the U.S., like European Central Bank, Bank of England, whatever, right? Because all the small banks just, you know, it was anathema to have a central bank, a government central bank, so we called it a Federal Reserve. And, you know, the notes are Federal Reserve notes, the currency, right? Kind of a euphemism here. So the big bankers got together after the 1907-08 crash. National City Bank, Kuhn Loeb, Chase Bank, First National Bank of New York. These are New York banks, big banks, J.P. Morgan, so forth. And they passed some temporary legislation called the Eldridge-Vreeland Act, but it wasn't enough. And who was this guy Aldridge? Aldridge was a Rhode Island senator who was tied into the banking families, including the Rockefellers and the others. He was their man in government, right? And he and others got together in 1910 at J.P. Morgan's club in a place called Jekyll Island. And they quietly developed this new proposal for a Federal Reserve, a central bank of the U.S., which would have the authority to issue currency, monopoly, that would be able to extend what was called the clearinghouse. That's how banks reconcile their bills to each other that existed in New York through across the whole country, which gives them a lot of control, you see, and provide money for bailing out financial crises, which were always occurring, right? There was no deposit insurance yet. You know, that would have to come through the government, not the central bank. And, you know, the government didn't want to create a solution yet to bail out the rest of Main Street with deposit insurance. Just bail out the banks and the investors in the banks. So what happens is this proposal developed at Jekyll Island becomes pretty much lobbied for the next couple of years here, 11 and 12, and finally enters Congress in 11 and 12. You know, this is no big conspiracy. You know, sometimes people on libertarians on the far right describe this as a conspiracy, the old meat secret in Jekyll Island, you know. Well, this is standard practice. Banks and, you know, capitalists, you know, they're not going to telegraph what they're doing before they do it. You know, they're going to quietly do it on the side. And this occurs all the time, you know, even today. They went out and lobbied it, you know, after they developed it, so everyone knew about it for at least 2 years. You know, of course, they kept the minutes of the meeting secret for a long time, decades. You know, who was actually there and so forth. They just let this guy Aldrich and others push it and become law. Well, it becomes law in 1913 because it looks like there's going to be another financial crisis by 1913 because war is coming in Europe. In fact, they almost went to war in 1912, and that kind of gave impetus to, okay, quick, we got to get this central bank thing done, before the war occurs in England, because a lot of the instability in the U.S. banking system has to do with Europe and the U.S. and gold flows between Europe and the U.S. I won't get into all the details of that, but, the U.S. knew that its instability of its financial and banking system was linked to Europe, because we had these close ties with London, New York banking systems. Okay, so they passed the Federal Reserve Act in 1913. Now, it's interesting to note that the Federal Reserve Act created a Federal Reserve Central Bank that was really run by the private banks. Yes, there were 12 districts, and each one of those districts had a committee of nine people. Six had to be bankers, And three could be from the community, but the acceptance of the three nominees had to be accepted by the bank, the other six. So there's veto over the community members of the committees. So nine-member committees, all bankers are banker friends, you see. Each bank, district bank, ran their own operations. In other words, independently of Washington. These were corporations. These district banks were corporations. They raised stock. They bought their own stock. Right? They paid themselves dividends on their stock. Well, that's like a private bank, isn't it? Yeah, we created 12 private banks that acted like central banks. They issued their own notes. Each district had their own Federal Reserve notes of San Francisco, whatever. Each bought gold, bought foreign exchange. Right? Each invested in real estate in their areas. Each paid themselves, their own shareholders, dividends. Sounds like a private bank to me, doesn't it? Yeah. It was. They were private banks. So we got this facade, this fiction created in the Federal Reserve Act that these were government institutions that were going to, if necessary, bail out the private banks. No, no. They were private institutions that had the cover of being a government agency that acted like private banks, did everything private banks did, but had the a collective additional authority to bail themselves out, right, by creating this single currency monopoly, issuing single currency monopoly, whenever they got in trouble, and they always got in trouble, you see. The New York District Federal Reserve was the central bank of central banks of the districts, you see, even more powerful than all the rest. So we start out the central bank, the Federal Reserve, as really a private bank acting like a government bank, but really run by and for the interests of the regional private banks in these 12 districts in the U.S. That was the Federal Reserve, you see. A monopoly over the money, currency, and the money supply, and the ability to supervise themselves, you know. Yeah, bank supervision, supervise yourself. No, it doesn't work in the banking sector. Self-supervision has never worked. Well, and it didn't work then either. What you got here is the most undemocratic institution in the United States, the Federal Reserve System. Back then, it was really undemocratic. There were some reforms we'll talk about next time in the 1930s when the banks collapsed, banking system collapsed, and the Federal Reserve stood by and actually made it worse. Yeah, protecting their own interest and making the whole thing worse. Including the banking system, three banking crashes in the early 1930s, and when federal FDR comes into office, you know, there are some significant banking reforms at 33 to 35. And the Federal Reserve is sort of reconstructed a little bit, but not significant enough. It's still a private bank acting like a public bank on behalf of everybody, but the banking interests, private banking interests, are dominant still. Well, we'll talk about in the book, and we'll talk about that more next week. And we'll watch what happens with the Federal Reserve raising rates next week. What's going to happen? All right. This is Alternative Visions, Jack Rasmus.